We thank you, O God, for the gift that you give to us in so many different ways, for the gift of rain and sunshine, for the gift of this place and the people who make it such a wonderful place. We pray for strength and guidance for ourselves and for the churches that we represent as we leave here and as we go in different directions. Help us to trust in you for all things. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, we're going to try to cover 18, 19, 20, and 21, four chapters. And these are crucial chapters because this is the climax of the story of Jesus. In the first section, from verse 1 to 11, you have the story of him going to Gethsemane. And when we reenacted this whole thing back in 1975 with Bruce Schein, we simply walked out of the old city and we walked down the hill and across the ravine and we got to the place where Gethsemane was. There is still a garden there and there are still olive trees that might have been planted about the time of Jesus. And so we meditated as we walked along, and we thought about Jesus and his suffering. Notice in this section that there are not only Jewish guards, but there are Roman guards and Roman soldiers there. The other Gospels don't bring in the Roman presence at this point. They simply talk about the Jewish guards. And the question becomes, why was it necessary to bring in the Romans? And why does John mention them? He usually is very careful about what he brings in and what he leaves out. And so he's saying that these guards were there. And the question becomes, why was there a tendency on the part of the writers of the first four Gospels to minimize the responsibility of Rome and to emphasize the responsibility of the Judeans, or the Jews, if you like? What would have caused them to be hesitant to bring in the responsibility of Rome? Anyone have an idea?
Fear.
Fear of what?
The Romans.
Yeah. Yeah, they could well have wondered, you know, if we write down that the Romans did this, that that would have been hard for the Christian communities across the empire. That's what I think. And remember that the high priest had to be very careful in what he did toward the Roman procurator, because his position had to be approved by Rome. And so even he may have even had to toady to them in order to protect his position. And then notice that Jesus steps forward and says, "Who are you looking for?" when they confront him. And they say, Jesus the Nazarene. And he says, "I am he." And then the whole group falls down. Why would they fall down? Any ideas? The words, "I am he." Do you remember them?
I've always thought of that at that moment in time. The divinity, the divine part of Christ, showed forth. Mm-hmm. And they were...
And how would they know that the divine form was there?
My imagination won't go that far. Tell me.
Remember we said, "I am he."
Yeah.
Those are the words for "I am that I am,"
yeah.
God's name. And so for him to say that in a dramatic way was shocking. At least to the Jews, it would have been shocking. And possibly the effect was transmitted to the Romans too, because the group falls back and even falls to the ground. And then Jesus says, "If I am the one you are looking for, let these others go." So he's concerned about his own people. And he's concerned that they not be arrested when he was arrested. And then Pilate, or Peter, attempts to attack and cuts off the right ear. If he cut off the right ear of a man, he had to be left-handed, didn't he? You know, if the person is facing you, either he's striking from behind with his right hand, or he's striking with his left facing the man. Otherwise, you can't do anything to the right ear of somebody if you're striking with your right hand. Could have been twisted, but it seems to be unlikely that you would be able to do that unless you were left-handed. Then they go to the residence of Annas and Caiaphas, and they quote again the words of Caiaphas. Remember, we had those words back in chapter 12, or 11, I guess it was. It's better for one man to die for the people. Then notice that Simon Peter, in verse 15, goes with, or tries to follow Jesus. And notice the disciple, this disciple who was known to the high priest, went with Jesus into the high priest's palace. This disciple is probably John. I mean, that's the assumption that I'm making. And I admit that it's an assumption. But how would he have had access to the high priest's area? How would John, as an ordinary citizen in the capital, have had this kind of access? Any ideas?
He says he was known to the high priest.
No, and how would he be known? What kind of business could he have been doing that would have made him known? Legal, yeah. What else?
One idea would be that he was a fisherman.
Yeah.
And they have catered to the high priest and his cuisine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They provided the household with all the fish.
Yep. And remember, I think I mentioned this earlier, but the fish from the Sea of Galilee was prized. It was dried and shipped all over the empire, and was apparently a delicacy, even in Rome.
I don't know what they called that fish before. Now they call it pink fish.
Yeah, yeah. Could be.
I don't know what they called it before.
Okay. So that's how they got in. The other disciple, who I think is John, has access because he's known to the group there. And he gets in, and then he brings Peter in. And then Peter is challenged by the group, "Aren't you another of that man's disciples?" So another would indicate that John was known then as a disciple. And for Peter then to be questioned, "Aren't you another?" Would have indicated that he could have admitted that since his friend was a disciple, he was too. But I think Peter at this point is so either afraid or else so discouraged about his position with regard to Jesus that he can't admit that he was part of Jesus' group. It's either fear or a combination of fear and discouragement with the job of being a disciple.
Could it possibly be that Peter in his temperament thought possibly that he might be able to still do something to thwart the release?
Yeah.
Christ,
yeah.
The authorities.
That's right. That's right.
It was a fighting man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. It could have been. All those things are possible. Then Jesus is questioned very carefully, and and he is slapped because the people assume that the guards around the high priest assume that Jesus is being insolent by speaking directly and evenly to him. And Jesus says, if there is something wrong in what I said, point it out. But if there is no offense in it, why do you strike me? And that brings us down to Peter's denying that he has any connection with Jesus three times. And after the third time, it says, a cock crew. Now, the information that I have is that chickens were not allowed in Jerusalem. So how could there be a cock crowing? And the explanation seems to be that there was a trumpet blast that sounded at 3 a.m., and it was called the cock crow. You can take that for what it's worth. That's the information that I've had, and that trumpet that sounded at 3 a.m. was called the cock crow. And it doesn't say that Peter went off and wept, you see. That's another sign of John's way of dealing with these things. I can't remember what the reason was given for that. I don't know.
That country, I mean, just like the other third world countries, the chickens everywhere, and the baddie types, and also the, you can hear the cocks crow for quite a distance. I mean,
That's right. That cock crow could have been outside. Could have been outside the city.
And the Garden of Gethsemane is across the Kidron Valley from Jerusalem.
That's right. So there are a number of explanations for that. So you can take that for what it's worth. I don't know if it's worth anything or not. Let's take a look at Pilate now for a few minutes. Pilate was an interesting person. He was a strong leader of men. But when it came to the Jews, he somehow lost his courage. And there's a background to that. Three times he had challenged the Jews, and three times he had lost. In the first instance, he brought in standards into the city. And these standards had a bust of the emperor on top. And the Jews said to him, don't bring those into our city. It's against the law. And so he had to back down to that because the Jews all lined up and said, you can kill us if you want, but don't do that. And so rather than have a slaughter and have a scandal that would be reported in Rome and would be against his name, he backed away from that. And the second instance, he took money from the temple. Don't ask me how he got it, but if you're the Roman procurator, you have all kinds of authority and you can do things. He took some money, apparently a considerable amount of money, in order to build a water system. And the Jews heard about it and rioted, and many were killed. And that was another black mark against Pilate in his confrontation with the Judeans. And the third time, the name Tiberius was printed or woven onto the shields of the Roman guards, and the Jewish leaders asked him to take that off because it was offensive to them. And that dispute about whether that name Tiberius could be on the shields went all the way back to Rome, and according to the account, Pilate lost. And the names were removed. And so repeatedly he's had these confrontations with the Jewish leaders and he's failed. And so he's a little bit nervous about his relations with them. Notice also that that John has a considerable amount of material about Pilate. He has more material here than any of the other three. He seems to have known a good bit about it, and he seems to have felt that this was significant, and so he puts that in. Pilate was afraid and nervous in his relationships with the Jews. So in the first case, In verses 28 to 32, he asks the Jewish leaders, what charge do you bring against this man? And they respond, if he were not a criminal, we should not be handing him over to you, which is a kind of impudent way of speaking to him. And this indicates that the style in which they were accustomed to dealing with him. They deal from a kind of strength that is based on their power, their political power, I guess, their ability to embarrass him. And so they treat Pilate in a very impudent way. And then he says to them, take him yourselves and try him by your own law. And they say, we are not allowed to put a man to death. Now that wasn't completely true, but it was true as far as crucifixion was concerned. They could not crucify. They were not allowed to give that kind of punishment. But they could stone a person, and we know that from the first chapters of Acts where they stoned Stephen. And so he goes back into the praetorium, and he asks Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus' response is to say, do you ask this of your own accord, or have others spoken to you about me? And then Pilate says, am I a Jew? It's your own people and the chief priests who have handed you over to me. What have you done? And Jesus' response is, mine is not a kingdom of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my men would have fought to prevent my being surrendered to the Jews. But my kingdom is not of this kind. So you are a king then. It is you who say it, responds Jesus. Yes, I am a king. I was born for this. I came into the world for this, to bear witness to the truth. And all who are on the side of the truth listen to my voice. Truth? Said Pilate. What is that? And with that he went out again and said, I find no case against him. In other words, he's talked to Jesus and he's decided that Jesus is harmless. And he doesn't want to pronounce a sentence of death on a person who seems to be harmless. But then he tries to get out of it by releasing Jesus, as the custom of releasing one prisoner at the Passover. We can't find any evidence that that was in fact the custom, except the scriptures. That there doesn't seem to be any independent witness that this custom existed. But the fact that they put it here indicates that there was some tradition of that. And so then he tries to release Jesus according to that custom, and then the crowd cries out, not this man, but Barabbas. Now the question becomes, how could these people change so rapidly? On Sunday, there was a large crowd of people welcoming him into the city. And you all probably heard sermons in which we talk about the fickleness of the crowd. Sunday, they are welcoming Jesus, and on Friday, they are ready to crucify him, and they don't have any idea of giving mercy or anything like that. And I got a clue to what was happening there from our time in Jerusalem, because Bruce Schein says that the people who controlled things controlled who was allowed to enter that courtyard. And so it's very likely that the people who are crying out, crucify him, or release for us Barabbas, and so on, are a picked crowd of people. That is, only people who would agree with what the chief priests wanted, or who were on the chief priest's side, were allowed in. There was probably...
Or on their payroll.
Yeah, sure. And so there was probably a guard at the gate around this area, and that the number of people who came in was controlled. And only those who agreed with what the chief priests wanted were allowed in. And that makes a lot of sense. Because after all, there were several million people in Jerusalem, and a good many of them were excited about the possibility that Jesus was in fact the Messiah. And so they certainly the crowd would have had some of them in a general crowd. Even if the whole thing was done very secretly and very quickly, there would have been some of Jesus' friends who would have been there and would have easily called out for his release. At least that's the assumption that I've always made. So it makes a lot of sense to me to think of this crowd being very selected and picked.
Now, sometimes I liken their approach to our present situation, where the silent majority remains silent, and some legislation or whatever gets through.
Yeah.
Simply because we don't let speak out.
Yeah.
When we have an opinion.
Yeah.
A mob and does all kinds of things and to take our civil rights of them.
Yeah.
Things.
Yeah.
Mob hysteria on it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. I'd like to mention three ironies of this whole situation. There's the irony of the Jews seeming to be more concerned with the religious details of the law than they are with putting an innocent man to death. And the second irony is that the Roman leader seems more worried about the Jewish political power involved than he is about the danger of betraying the ideals of Roman justice. And the third irony is that Barabbas is charged unjustly, though he's charged justly with sedition, and he's the one who is set free. All kinds of ironies.
I don't know whether I can document this or not, but my understanding is Pontius Pilate had gone afoul of the emperor, and that this was like Siberia for a Russian. He was relegated to that outpost of Israel.
Yeah, yeah.
And any false move on his part that would get back to the emperor might very well strip him of his office.
Mm-hmm.
So he was operating under the fear.
Well, there were a lot of rumors, and rumor had a lot of power.
Right.
And one of the things that I learned when I was in Japan is that in a system whereby you have a center and then you have outposts, which was in fact the situation in the Roman Empire, the people who are sent from Tokyo to America or to some other part of the world are always nervous when they're away from Tokyo, because they're not at the center, and therefore they don't know what's being said about them or what's being decided about them, for them or against them. And you can understand that Pilate would have been several thousand miles away from Rome, and he was nervous about what was being said about him, because Tiberius was notoriously suspicious and distrustful, violently suspicious, according to what we've heard. And so he might have been saying certain things or hearing certain things, and who knows what Pilate's position was. There was a man by the name of Sejanus, S-E-J-A-N-U-S, Sejanus, who was Pilate's friend and who spoke for him to the emperor. But at this point, it seems Sejanus was in disfavor and couldn't protect Pilate. So for all those reasons, Pilate was probably nervous about his...
One other thing, I think the Herods, and King Herod was present in Jerusalem at that time. The Herods had an in with the emperor, too.
Uh-huh. And or he had some kind of power, yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah. He might not have been in, but he had a certain power because he was the king of...
Herod the Great had his office by virtue of the emperor.
Yeah, right. Okay, so then Pilate decides that he can have Jesus scourged. Now, scourging was a terrible punishment. Some men died under the lash, because what they did was they attached pieces of metal to the whip, and one slash with that would raise a series of welts across the back of the man, and if it was replied repeatedly, of course, the person would lose blood and would lose strength. And the fact that Jesus was able to survive that was a kind of a minor miracle. And then they mock him and dress him in a purple robe and greet him, "Hail, King of the Jews," and slap him around. And then Pilate brings him out to try to evince some kind of sympathy. He thinks maybe if the crowd sees this scourging and sees him bloody and wounded, that they will relent, and that may be enough, and then he can release him. At least that seems to have been his strategy. But the crowd then cries, "Crucify him, crucify him." And so Pilate then says, "Take him yourselves and crucify him. I can find no case against him." He doesn't want to pronounce this guilty. He doesn't want to pronounce this verdict against Jesus. And then the Jews reply, according to the law, he ought to die because he claimed to be the Son of God. But of course, that wasn't breaking Roman law. So how could Pilate then, on that basis, have Jesus crucified? So then he goes back again, and his fears increased, because he may have begun to suspect that Jesus was, in fact, the leader of this people, and that if he participates in his crucifixion, he will have the guilt of that. So he asked Jesus, "Where do you come from?" Now, at that point in the synoptic account, Jesus says Galilee, and then he's sent over to Herod. But John doesn't record that, and he records Jesus as saying nothing. And then Pilate says, "Are you refusing to speak to me? Surely you know I have power to release you, and I have power to crucify you." And Jesus' even response then is, "You would have no power over me if it had not been given you from above. That is why the one who handed me over to you has the greater guilt." And then Pilate becomes very anxious to set Jesus free. But the Jews shout, "If you set him free, you are no friend of Caesar's." This was their trump card, that we will report you to Rome if you do that. And then your position will become even weaker. And what they say to him then, they say, he says, "Here is your king, take him away, crucify him," is the response. "Do you want me to crucify your king?" in verse 15. And the chief priests answer, "We have no king except Caesar." That's a terrible thing for them to say. For the Jews who claimed God as their king, for the Jews who said, "We have no king except the Lord." And then for them to say this, it just seems to be the most awful thing that any group of Jews could ever have said. "We have no king except Caesar." That seemed, they're so desperate to get rid of Jesus that they will claim Caesar as their king in order to justify the sentence. And so then Pilate hands him over. And he kind of gives up. So you can see them jockeying back and forth, seeing what their position can be, what can they do to try to get what they want. And Pilate is maneuvered back and back and back, and finally he's in a corner and he can't get out. And so he has to allow Jesus to be crucified. It's a sad story, and a story of duplicity and lack of courage, and cowardice.
And mock trial.
Yeah, yeah. It was a mock trial in the very realist sense. And remember that at the sixth hour the lambs would have been sacrificed. This would have been the time when the lambs were being killed in order to prepare for Passover, because Passover was going to begin at sundown. So Jesus is forced to carry his own cross, and he's crucified between two others, and Pilate writes out a notice that says, "Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews." Now, they object to that, because they want him to write, "He said, I am the King of the Jews." But at this point, Pilate becomes very stubborn and says, "What I have written, I have written." And he's not about to change that. Then Jesus' clothes are divided. Notice that, and it's very important to remember that one of the humiliations of crucifixion was that the prisoner was crucified naked. He didn't have any loincloth on, and it was total nakedness in a very hot situation. And one of the things that that comes at the end when they talk about breaking the legs of the people who are on the cross. The reason they did that was because that would hasten the death. If you could somehow raise yourself up enough to be able to breathe, then you could stay alive. But if your legs are broken, then you don't have any power to raise yourself up and you die of suffocation because you can't breathe. It was a painful form of execution, no question about that. Now, the clothes that Jesus had, there were five pieces of traditional clothing: sandals, a turban, a loincloth, a tunic, and a cloak. And there were four soldiers. Duty of this awful thing of having to crucify somebody was considered a hazardous duty or difficult duty, and so they were allowed to get the bonus of the clothing that the prisoner had worn. But since there were five items and four soldiers, they needed to work it out, and so they had to throw dice to see who would get the seamless robe that was Jesus, and was apparently made by his mother and would have been a gift to him at the time he left his home. Notice that among the cries from the cross, you do not hear the cry, "Why have my God, why have you abandoned me?" The reason he doesn't put it in, at least it seems to me, is because of his theme that Jesus is in control and that Jesus is expressing the glory of God, and that word would not have been very appropriate. So again, he's selecting what he puts in. Whereas the three synoptic gospels present Jesus as a suffering servant from beginning to end, John presents Jesus as one who is glorified, and all that he does helps him to glorify God and is expressing the glory of God. You know, that's one of his favorite words. Notice the physical details that are included. I am thirsty, and that expresses his physical need, because he couldn't have even spoken. He wouldn't have been able to say anything if he didn't have some water. So his physical nature is emphasized at that point. And that's probably in order to counter the claim of the Gnostics. Remember, the Gnostics were people who said Jesus could not have been the Son of God if he had a physical body, because physical nature is evil. And so if Jesus was the Son of God, he must have been pure spirit. And they played that out all the way to the point where they would have said that Jesus was not a physical person. Jesus was a pure spiritual person. And so the church had to over and over again emphasize the physical side of Jesus' life in order to counter that claim. When Jesus says to his mother and to John, "A woman, this is your son, and son, this is your mother," why is it necessary for him to say that? I mean, Jesus had other brothers. We know that from John's account. Why was it necessary for him to designate a person to take care of his mother? Does anyone have a clue?
I think he was still talking about the kingdom of God.
Yeah?
His last sermon.
Yeah?
To illustrate to the others there that what the children of God represent.
Yeah, and why couldn't his brothers have done that?
They could have, but I think it was more dramatic, or if that's the proper word.
What do you think?
He was the first son.
Yeah.
Of Mary.
Yeah.
And they usually had more response. They had the responsibility.
Yeah, but why couldn't he pass that off to his own brothers?
They were half brothers.
I'm not sure about that. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I believe it was because Jesus' brothers were not believers yet.
Okay.
And that he wanted to make sure that his mother was cared for within the Christian understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And a widow at that day, without any support, mm-hmm. without any family,
mm-hmm.
was in a disastrous state.
Mm-hmm.
They were less than cattle in the field.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That seems to have been the case, that he wanted his mother taken care of by someone who was a part of the community. And his brothers at this point had not yet believed, as far as we know. And so he has to select one of his own group to take care of his mother. And that's what he does. The other point to make is that if you are dying, and if you are thirsty, and if you are under intense pressure and physical pain, how can you think of anyone else except yourself? I remember a classmate of mine in seminary whose mother was dying of cancer, and she reported that her physical pain was such that if she hadn't had the habit of prayer so deeply ingrained, she wouldn't have been able to pray. Because pain tends to focus on the self, and we become so wrapped up in the pain that we are experiencing that we can't think about anyone else. And so the remarkable thing is that Jesus was able to think of other people and to talk about other people. And so he's concerned for his mother and his disciple. And then he finally utters this cry, it is accomplished, which in Hebrew would have been the word tetelestai. He was in charge of his life and he was in charge of his future, and he is able to say that it is accomplished and let his own life go. He had a physical nature and he expressed that. And the vinegar that is passed up to him was a sign of sympathy. The question of what kind of water or what kind of vinegar was given to him is often debated on Good Friday, and we hear sermons both ways, saying that he won't take it because it's passed up in such a way as to increase his pain. But I think it was a sympathetic gesture to give him some moisture and to help him to be able to say something.
I believe that they have two different fluids involved.
Uh-huh.
And at first, it was a cheap wine laced with an anesthetic or something.
Uh-huh.
To deaden the feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was a requirement laid down by the women of Jerusalem. They couldn't do away with the crucifixion, but they at least felt out that they could do something about alleviating the pain for the victim. And then the other would have been just some of the cheap wine without being laced with a sedative or whatever.
Yeah.
That was used by the soldier. And I remember reading a book, I think it was called The Robe. Maybe you read that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The robe where the soldiers that were assigned to the duty of crucifixion, by the time they got to the site of the crucifixion, they were so drunk they couldn't. They didn't have any moral feelings whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be drunk in order to carry through.
Yeah, yeah. And, okay. And finally, after Jesus is dead, and notice that they have to break the legs, and then when they come to Jesus, they realize that he's already dead, and so they put a spear through his side and blood and water come out. The blood represents the sacrament of the altar, and the water represents baptism. Because John is always interested in the symbolic meaning of the activities and the actions. And so he puts a lot of emphasis on certain numbers and on certain actions. The blood is the sacrament of the altar, and the water is the sacrament of baptism. And notice that John puts in verse 35, this is the evidence of one who saw it. Trustworthy evidence, and he knows he speaks the truth, and he gives it so that you may believe as well. Because all this happened to fulfill the words of Scripture, not one bone of his will be broken. So this is another point where John says, I saw it, and it's true, and I'll testify to it. And then after he's dead, his own disciples are not there to take care of his body. So who comes forward? Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, who are Jesus' secret sympathizers from the other side. And they have asked Pilate for the privilege of burying Jesus, and so they come in and take him away. And notice the amount of the spices, 100 pounds of spices. That seems to be sympathetic to when Jesus creates wine at Cana, he creates an abundance of wine, more than enough. And this seems to be more than enough. Would have been enough for a king. And in fact, Jesus was a king. And so it's not so surprising that they would have that quantity of spices there, because Jesus was doing things in an abundant way. And so this was appropriate. Any questions up to that point or comments? We have a few minutes left to deal with the resurrection. And so early on the first day of the week, Mary of Magdala comes, and she is the first person to whom Jesus reveals himself after the resurrection. But she sees that the tomb is open, and so she runs back and tells the disciples, and they run. John, at least it seems, John and Peter have a track race, and John seems to be the winner. And that's an interesting detail that they put in here. It's interesting the way in which the details are put in, and it's got to be somebody who was there. You can't have this kind of detail coming out from somebody who's getting it secondhand. And then they go in and see that the linen cloths are on the ground, and the cloth that had been over his head, this was not with the linen cloths, but rolled up in a place by itself. And Jan was trying to struggle with that last week, and she said she couldn't come up with any reason, and I can't either, except that if you have something over your head, that could go this way, and the rest of the clothes could go in another direction if the body is being removed from all the wrappings.
Yeah, I think I think we mentioned also last week that there's a possibility that if the body was snatched by someone,
yeah,
that the cloth may have fallen off of his face, but did a heat or something like that.
Yeah.
Whereas here, the cloth is neatly folded up and laid aside.
Yeah, that
so
could be.
Indicating that the individual who wore that over the face was the one who neatly that
folded
up,
waited
beside, and left.
Yeah. Well,
these are all conjectures.
Yeah. Right. Now, Mary's outside, and she does not suspect that Jesus has risen from the dead. Okay, that's clear. What she's thinking is that somebody may have stolen the body, because grave robbery was rather common. Particularly if the robbers thought that there might have been some precious elements buried with him, or he might have had a ring on his finger or some valuable thing that they could get from him. And so the assumption that Mary makes is that someone has stolen the body and she would like to recover it. And so she speaks to the person that she's talking to as though he is the gardener. Woman, why are you weeping? Jesus says to her, but she doesn't recognize his voice. And then she turns around and says to him, they have taken my Lord away, and I don't know where they have put him. And then she turns around and sees Jesus there, and she doesn't recognize him. And then he speaks again. Woman, why are you weeping? So it's the same kind of thing we have in the Gospel of Luke with the two disciples on their way to Emmaus. They have a long conversation with Jesus along the way, and he tells them all the things from the Old Testament. And they still don't recognize his voice because they are so sure that it can't be Jesus. In this case, too, she's face to face with him. And it takes her a few minutes before she recognizes that he is, in fact, her Lord. And then when she realizes it, she addresses him in a very respectful way. And she uses the word Rabboni, which was a very elegant form of the term rabbi. And Jesus says, do not cling to me. And the note in the Jerusalem Bible says, Mary has fallen at the feet of Jesus to embrace them. And because I have not yet ascended to the Father. And I don't have any clues as to why she should not embrace him, except that his body was not the kind of physical body that you and I have. And so he would have a spiritual body or some kind of a body that could be seen but not felt, because he could pass through walls and enter a room. And
but why did he tell Thomas to put your fingers?
So there was it had a quality that you could see it, but I don't know why he says she can't touch him.
I think Jan last week said, you know, another translation here is hold me. Not to detain him, not to hold him back, but we need to.
No, because he certainly knew it was Mary's face.
Yeah.
Where Thomas was doubtful and he wanted to illustrate.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Physically became a body for him to touch.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Didn't he also have to go to the Father right away to be glorified or something?
Yeah.
You know, it says but, that I've not yet ascended to the Father.
But the ascension would have been later. I mean, that would have been 40 days later.
Yeah, I knew that. But I thought that that's how he got it.
Oh, there's an interesting question about Mary here. It's possible that Mary was a wealthy woman, and she may have given a lot of funds to Jesus to support his ministry. And she may have been a very prominent part of the early church. And therefore, Jesus' appearance to her could have been put in here in honor of all that she had done for Jesus. And so she could have been a wealthy person. She could have been very significant as an outsider or as a redeemed, reformed prostitute. We don't know for sure. But it's interesting that she gets the prominence that she does here in the story, because she's the first person to whom Jesus presents himself.
Well, I personally do not believe that it's beyond human imagination that Jesus in the glorified condition after his resurrection would be not easily recognized by even his so he chose to be recognized as the one on the road to Emmaus. When he broke the bread, then they recognized him.
Yeah.
A familiar act and so forth.
Yeah.
And the same way with Mary. The familiar way that he must have said, Mary, opened up her eyes to who he really was. I believe also that he ascended to the Father after the resurrection simply to fully corroborate the fact of the resurrection and the fact that it is the glorified body, and then return. Now all of that could have taken less time than you can blink an eyelash.
Oh, you think there was an ascending to the Father?
Yes.
Well, it says here, but I'm not yet ascended.
Do not hold me until I have ascended to the Father. But then, in one of the other accounts, in the Matthew's account, the women, the other women, encountered Jesus on their way from the tomb back to the city, and they hold him. They fall at his feet and grasp his feet in worship.
I see.
So I think that there was an interim, brief interim period there, where from the, at the moment of resurrection, Jesus encountered Mary, and then told her that because he still had to, felt he had to go to the Father in heaven, and then come back again.
It's possible. The Jerusalem Bible, the note in the Jerusalem Bible seems to say that.
He can go through Telegram.
Right. Yeah. Well, then he appears to the disciples. This is Sunday night. And he greets them with peace be with you. And that was a traditional greeting. But why would they have been so overjoyed that he greeted them that way? Because they realized that they had let him down. And that they did not expect that kind of a familiar greeting from someone that they had abandoned. And so they were so pleased to hear him say that. And then it says in verse 22 that he breathed on them. So it seems as though John is collapsing both the resurrection and Pentecost and the ascension all into one event. So that they in fact received the Holy Spirit already on Sunday night. The day of his resurrection becomes the day of Pentecost. And he says, receive the Holy Spirit, for those whose sins you forgive, they are forgiven. He doesn't need a separate book or a separate story to talk about Pentecost because it's already here. But Thomas wasn't there, and so Jesus appears a week later and says that Thomas should put his finger here and look at my hands. Give me your hand and put it in my side, and so on. Doubt no longer, but believe. And then Thomas makes his famous declaration, my Lord and my God, which would have been a Jewish way of speaking of God. That was a very profound way of speaking of God. There are four types of faith represented, or at least four. The type of faith that John represents, who sees the empty tomb and believes, and then Mary hears and believes, the disciples hear, see, and believe, and Thomas seeing, hearing, touching, and believing. And then as Dean pointed out at the last session, Dean Peterson, he said, and then those of us who don't have any of that evidence, but we believe. Happy are those who have not seen and yet believe, in verse 29. So there are different patterns by which we come to faith, different ways in which we experience Jesus, and we have to recognize that and be respectful of the differences. Some gradually develop a faith, and some get it very quickly. And so we have to respect the obvious differences. Another point is that all the disciples have now become teachable. they realized how much they needed to learn. And I think that's an interesting point, that all the way through the Gospel of John, we've seen the disciples struggling to know who Jesus was and how they could relate to him. And they think they know, but then they realize at the end that they really don't understand him. And so they have become very teachable in that process. The question is, why is is chapter 21 included? Because it seems to go back to an earlier period when he is, I'm not sure about that. Because he's up at the Sea of Galilee, and I'm wondering, why is it called an appendix? Because this chapter has been as a part of all the manuscripts that we've had up to now, but still it's called an appendix. And it's a little unclear as to why. But there are some good reasons when you read it as to the importance of this passage. Because in this passage, Simon Peter gets his renewal. His name is now not so bad as it had been, because he had abandoned Jesus and he denied any connection with him. But he needs to be revived. He needs to be restored to his original position if he is going to be considered the leader of the group. And so John has one point of view and Peter has another point of view, but the two of them have connected here in this last chapter. And Peter is now restored to his position as leader. And Jesus says to him three times, "Do you love me?" And why does he say it three times? He doubted and he denied three times. And so he needs to be restored three times. And along the way, typical of Peter, he becomes impatient with that. He was upset, it says here in my Jerusalem Bible, verse 17. Peter was upset that he asked him the third time, "Do you love me? You know everything. You know I love you. Feed my sheep." The book seems to have come to a conclusion at the end of chapter 20, and then this is added on later. But and there's one more point about the 153 fish. That's another number, you know, and that's significant. So there have been a lot of efforts made to try to understand 153. Jan said it comes from the book of Ezekiel. But I also have some information that if you take the Ten Commandments and the seven virtues, that becomes 17. 3 times 17 is 51. And 3 times 51 is 153. Now why times 3? Because when you had a catch like that, a third of the catch would go to the owner of the boat, a third to the fisherman who took it in, and a third to the provider of the nets. And so the 3 times 17 is 51, and 3 times 51 is 153. Another way to arrive at 153 is to take 17, which we started with the Ten Commandments and the seven virtues, and then take 17, 16, 15, 14. If you go all the way down, it becomes 153. You can add it up yourself. You can take your choice as to how you want to interpret these numbers, but we need to do something with that 153, it seems to me. Okay. I think that's all I have to say. Thank you very much for your attention. I've enjoyed the experience.